You are listening to Amplify Your Success Podcast, episode 176. And today, I want you to forget the 80-20 rule and discover that it's really the 1% that matters. I've brought a special guest to share how he's proven this out in a very successful business. So let's get started.
Welcome to the Amplify Your Success Podcast. Hey, are you a thought leader, creative entrepreneur, or change maker and want to magnify your impact? Boost influence while creating a financial abundance? Stay tuned for today's inspiring episode with your host, Melanie Benson.
Hey there, inspired entrepreneurs and business leaders. It's your host, Profit Amplifier, Melanie Benson. And today, I've got a special guest who's going to help us banish this idea that the 80-20 rule can govern our decision making, and why it's really only the 1% that matters. And I was very intrigued by this concept. So I look forward to sharing this really intriguing conversation with you. And hopefully you'll leave with some proven strategies and some new thinking of how you're going to grow your business. And while we're on the subject of growing our business, something that I noticed is oftentimes we cannot always plan for big clients to leave, for someone unexpectedly to not be able to pay their bill. And sometimes, even though you've got a great business, or maybe you're just starting out, you need cash flow. You need revenue coming in now. So I designed 10 proven revenue rush strategies. I've tested them out on my business, tested them out on my clients' businesses. And what I found is that you can use these when you need the most and set them up within a very few short days and create some cash when you need it the most. Or you can try some of these and put them into action all the time. And what you'll find is it'll boost your revenue somewhere between 40 and 60%. That's pretty significant, right? So get my free download, Your Revenue Rush Strategies, at yourrevenuerush.com. And let me know, which one do you put into action and how is it working for you? Now, let's get into today's episode. My guest today says it's time to forget the 80-20 rule and focus on the 1% that matters. Let me introduce you to my guest, David Finkel. Now, David is a serial entrepreneur. He's the CEO of Maui Mastermind, which is one of the world's premier business coaching companies, which has worked with over 100,000 business leaders, helping them grow their companies and get their lives back. David's clients enjoy an average annual growth rate 5 times higher than the average privately held company in the United States. And at the same time, these business leaders have dramatically decreased their working hours. Over the past 20 years, David and the other Maui coaches and advisors have personally started and scaled companies with an aggregate value of $63 billion. Oh my gosh, take that in, $63 billion. The Wall Street Journal bestselling author of 11 books, David's syndicated business articles on Inc.com, FastCompany.com, and Forbes.com have garnered millions of readers. His work has been featured in prestigious media outlets like The Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg Businessweek, Fox Business, MSNBC, and Inc. Magazine. And now he's being featured right here on Amplify Your Success Podcast. So, David, I'm excited to have this conversation with you today.
Well, I appreciate that, Melanie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Isn't it funny when people are reading your introduction and you're like,
it always feels strange.
Like, you know, that's me she's talking about.
Oh, it's the most painful part of every interview. It really is.
Yeah, I know. It's that little dose of humility, right? You're like, wow, okay, yes, that's me.
And I'm still going to go home and none of my kids are going to listen to me. And my wife's going to go tell me to, you know, clean up the dishes after dinner, and as she should.
Right, exactly. We're still normal people. Well, I love this concept of the 80-20 principle being like outdated, and we're going to talk about that today. But first, I just want to take a step back. You've been coaching tens of thousands of business owners. What do you think is the big trap that locks these business owners into this endless round of doing, but maybe not seeing the results they want?
You know, Melanie, it's actually I come from a medical family. My dad's a doctor. And so I look at the medical reasoning for it. There's this thing called control-itis, the inflammation of our control gland. And what I mean by that is most entrepreneurs, most business leaders, whether I'm leading a department or a division or it's just me by myself, we grab on so tightly, we're so scared of feeling out of control that it's hard for us to hand it to somebody else. I can't tell you the number of business leaders I talk with who say, well, I've handed it to other people and they just don't do it as well as I do it, or they don't do it the right way. And all I can do is just cringe when they say that, because what I know is they're working way too much and they're underperforming. If I thought the extra hours made them better, I would cheer them on, but it doesn't. It actually reduces their amount of value that they can create because they have not learned how to intelligently and effectively hand to other people. But controlitis is the big trap.
Controlitis. I love that. Yeah. So, and I found it's interesting both ways. Like sometimes the people have too much control and sometimes maybe not enough control, right? They're not really getting their brain wrapped around it enough. And everything's just kind of slip sliding around.
Yeah. But when they do that though, usually what I notice is abdication is what we'll call it. And the reason they abdicate is because it's too painful for them to watch somebody else do it differently or subpar to what they could do. And I'm the same way. I mean, I teach workshops all across the country. And when I have staff teaching at times, I just walk out. Not my staff are great at teaching, but it's hard for me to let go. And so sometimes I have to kind of completely let go because if I'm incrementally involved, it's difficult. So I think most people who let go too much, it's just that's been their defensive way of saying, well, I know I can't do it all, so I'll just hand it off and close my eyes and hope, which is a pretty poor strategy for delegating success.
Mm. I've seen that happen quite a bit, actually.
I bet.
Well, let's talk about what does work. So you have this book, Freedom Formula, which is a really exciting premise. I think there's so much that we all need to hear about in this book, but I want to dig into the 80-20 principle and how it doesn't quite go far enough. And I recently read an article that you wrote about the math, which I was like trying to follow. And I'm like, this is really brilliant. Like, this is a great mind that came up with this math. But you actually can prove out like why it's not working.
Yeah. Yeah. And I won't make anyone listening here to amplify your success have to do the math. I'll do it for them. But here's the premise, right? Most people have very little distinctions around time, Melanie. Maybe they have weekends and weekdays or work days. And these are the people who are, you know, getting a paycheck and they're just punching a clock. But for people who are ambitious, they've got another distinction around time. They call it the 80-20 distinction, right? 80% of what I do creates very little value. We'll call that a D activity, low value, low result, that 80% mass. And 20% of what I do gives me 80% of the result. We'll call that C time. So think about it. One quarter the input gives me four times the output, which means every hour of C time, by definition, is 16 times, not 16%, but 16 times more valuable than an hour of D activities. And we know this, right? If I'm an attorney, me sitting there plowing through my inbox and handling low value email versus me doing billable work that I can bill at $585 an hour, clearly the billable work is more valuable. But it doesn't go far enough, because if I just lock into that distinction, what I don't realize is there's a magnitude more value. So if 20% of what I do gives me 80% of the result, then 20% of the 20% gives me 80% of the 80%. We call this 4% sweet spot B time. And again, the math just says 4% input gives you 64%, which is the 80% of the 80% of your output. And if you bear with me for one more math moment, I'll do it again. 20% of the 20% of the 20% gives you 80% of the 80% of the 80%. We call that A time. Technically, the math says it's 0.8%, but I just call it 1%. And it gives you half the result. Now, Melanie, I don't believe that these numbers are exactly gospel, but I think what they are is they share with you that there's a relative difference. And I'll go back to this professional who's working hourly. So one of the companies we coached, I shared the story of Marvin in this first chapter of the Freedom Formula. And here we were working with this guy. He bills $600 an hour. Actually, technically, it's $595 an hour. He's a senior partner of a small law firm with four attorneys and about, 22, 23 people total in the office. And I remember talking with him and him saying, you know, the only thing I do that creates the most value is I've got to do my billable work. And he was cranking out 70, 75 hours of billable work. And he'd been doing this for 30 years. I challenged him. I said, Marvin, there's some things that you could do that would be even more valuable. And he resisted. You know, what's more valuable than that? I mean, I get paid essentially $1 million a year for doing billable work. And my comment to him was, well, yes, but let's do a couple things. So any professional service firm, I know they need to look at their collections practices, and they need to look at their billing rates, and they need to look at a couple of other key areas that, you know, you coach enough businesses, you see the shortcuts for them. And he did these things, and it took him about 10 hours of his time to make some important decisions and do a little bit of analysis. It took his two or three key staff members about 20 hours of their time. And as a result, Melanie, they increased their profit of their firm by $500,000, not gross, but net profit, pre-tax profit. And if you look at the hourly, 30 hours of input gave him $500,000 more profit. That's what A-level activities will do for you. You can't do that. It's not about more hours, more effort. It's about making sure you're really identifying those things that create the highest value and putting some of your best resources on those things.
Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer in this. I've personally seen how kind of it's almost like you have to part the distraction sea and really understand when I focus on this thing, it propels my business, my revenue.
That's right.
And maybe even it's like you're wanting to invest in creating new opportunity, whatever that thing is. And I always get, David, I'm sure you get this all the time. Like I always get asked from people like, I'm working so hard, but I'm not getting traction. Like nothing's really working. It sounds like this is the remedy that you focus on.
Yeah. I mean, look, now we have to operationalize how to do it. I mean, Melanie, a lot of people know this intellectually, but what happens is they get back into the rut. They're overwhelmed with email and projects and tasks and all those C and D stuff just overwhelm them. And their time gets fractured into 1,000 different slivers. And that's why in the Freedom Formula, we talk about how do you reclaim some of your best time? How do you leverage an assistant, other the mechanics? But if we come from the premise that I don't get paid for hours and effort, what I'm getting paid for is the value I create, then I have to start by asking, what are the activities, what are the specific initiatives that if I invest in them will produce the most value? And if I run a company with, let's say, 1.5 million in sales, well, is my best use of time producing my product or my service offering, or is my best use of time in the marketing or sales side, or is my best use of time stepping back and making decisions that have far-reaching effects like pricing or decisions about which products or services to invest in or to let fade and die, or which marketplaces to go into or not, or the hiring of key people, or... And I think if we come from that place, what is it that I'm on the payroll to do that creates the most value? What are my A and B level activities? And if I can start there, boy, it's easy. And then, mm-hmm. you know, we can ignore C activities. Why? Because they're going to happen no matter what. The place to look at is I identify what are my A and B level activities in writing. And then I identify where's all the D level junk that's getting in the way. And the place to go is how do I reduce D so that I can reinvest blocks of my best attention in A or B activities. And if I do that, I can see 5 or 10 hours a week of that can make the difference between what I'm producing today and doubling or tripling my actual productive output of value created, not from working more, but from working better.
I totally agree. I'm like inspired by this conversation. And as you're listening in to David and I today, I want you to be thinking about like, what are your A-level activities? Do you even know what they are? And if not, you're going to want to keep listening and dig a little bit deeper with us, because knowing what your different activity payoffs are is the key to productivity, to, you know, really being able to grow a business that you love, right? Because if you're doing things that are at D level, probably you don't enjoy them all that much either.
Go ahead, Melanie.
Well, I was just going to say, I feel like this is a great segue into what you talk a lot about, which is leverage, which is one of my personal favorite words on the planet. It's like, if we could leverage our time more, you know, we're going to be spending more time in those A activities. But like, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how can we leverage a virtual assistant, a part-time assistant, maybe a personal assistant to reclaim some of that time to refocus our on our A activities?
It's a great question. And so people will ask that. And what they'll say is, I'm too busy to find an assistant, or to I don't have time to train an assistant, or I can't afford an assistant. These are the three things I hear most often than not. Sometimes I'll hear a fourth one, which is I don't have enough to give them, which is totally untrue. And so here's quickly four or five quick concrete tips that I would share. Number one, when you're thinking about who to hire, start with yourself. So I'm a quiet person by nature. I like a quiet office. I don't want my assistant to be chatty with me. Not for any other reason than when I'm at work, I want to get good stuff done. But then I want to go home and be with my kids and be with my family. So I have to be careful who I'm going to hire. So I have to think about that. Number two, I'm an auditory delegator. I don't want to have to meet with somebody. I want to just be able to share it with words. So I use a recording app that I can send a message. You know, if you could do it through WhatsApp, I use an app called Voxer. It's the same type of thing. I like information in writing though. I can read much faster and I can take notes right off of an email I print up like that. So knowing yourself helps you know who you need to hire. Secondly, with an assistant, I call it the one list. Everything that you hand to him or her should go onto one list. One list should be the guiding rule. They should not manage their to-dos via email because it's just too easy for things to get through the cracks. So, you know, a simple list tool would be Asana is a great tool. That's what I use with my two assistants. And they do a great job because I know it's on Asana. I can relax. And I don't have to put any mental attention to it. As long as it's on the project list, it means that the handoff was clean. And the number one reason why an assistant won't get something done generally is because the handoff was poor. And as long as they capture on that list, now I can just go into Asana. I look at the inbox. It's a feed which shows from newest to oldest what they've touched and where they stand. And it makes it much faster and more efficient. Number four, as trained to be in your SIA, then you probably shouldn't send it. Number two, you need to hire a mature person. Whether this person's young or old doesn't matter, but they need a degree of personal maturity. And my assistants are going to see things before other people in my companies do see them. And I trust that. I have a non-disclosure agreement in writing, sure, those things. But really the key is you hire someone who's got some maturity with that part. And the last kind of comment I would share with your assistant, and I think this is just such an easy one, is part of their job should be to create the system for being a great assistant for you. Early on, it's hard for you to give them stuff to do for the first 30 to 60 days as they learn who the players are, what the accounts are that you want them to buy it on Amazon for this or that, whatever you're handing to them, what are your travel preferences, what airlines, what are your frequent flyer numbers. So my assistants, every assistant I've ever had has contributed to keeping updated and current the system for how we do, being David's assistant. And so now Emily can go onto that and know how David likes aisle seats. David doesn't want to stay in a hotel near the ice machine or an elevator. He wants quiet rooms. He wants a small fridge because he goes and buys healthy food from the local whole grocer or Trader Joe's when he travels. You know, all those idiosyncratic things. But if you capture it in the system, your assistant is going to change over time. And so the person you have today, 1, 2, 3, 4 years from today, either is going to be promoted or you're going to have somebody else playing that role. So every assistant, part of their job from the point of hire, should be to document how to be a great assistant for you so that the next person starts with a little bit of a head start.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. And I mean, I think it all starts with a decision, right? Like my time, when I realize how valuable it can be to the business growth, when I'm in my A activities, it's a no-brainer why we should be having someone else help us free up our time, right?
Yeah.
I think it was Tim Ferriss that said, our job as entrepreneurs and business owners is not to get good at all the things in the business. It's to focus on the things that only we can do. And because we've got bigger fish to fry, like why get bogged down in all of it?
Yeah. And as a quick leadership test for yourself, the more successful you are as a business owner, the less you do. But the less you do matters a lot more. And early on in a business, you know, you're doing everything. But as the business matures, if you're maturing the business, not just growing it, but actually maturing its systems, its your team, your culture, then you personally do fewer things, but the things that you do matter a heck of a lot more.
That is true. I kind of think sometimes people's identities get a little messed up around this. Have you ever noticed that, right? Like the, especially if you're someone who you started a business because you, like maybe you realized that you weren't meant to be an employee like I was, or, you know, like they're corporate refugees, but we start this business and most of us are doing all of it right out of the gate. And then at a certain point, when you realize you can't keep doing that, do you notice that people's identities get a little messed up? It's like, well, what is my role?
Because they don't really,
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I know for me, like, for example, I was talking with somebody actually yesterday, last night at basketball practice for my kids. I was talking with a guy, I sold one of my companies. And after I sold it, I felt lost because if I'm not that business, who am I? You know, what that part? And I think as I've gotten older, one of the things I recognize is the things that I can do in the business that I'm great at doing might not necessarily be the things I should do. Like, for example, for years, I wanted to hang on to sales copywriting. Why? Because 25 years ago, I got my start as a copywriter. I was good at it. But the cool part is that if you're good at something, that's actually sometimes the easiest things to hand off to somebody else because you know who knows their stuff and you can tell right away if what they do is good quality or not. And I think business owners, we get messed up by trying to hang on to stuff that we're good at that we could easily get somebody else to do. Rather than asking, what am I good at? I need to ask, what does the business need me to do that creates the most value?
Mm-hmm. Well said. I agree 100%. And, you know, maybe this ties in too, but one of the things that really caught my eye in your work is what you call your sweet spot analysis tool. Mm-hmm. And I think it's such a great concept. I believe fully that if we understand what's in our sweet spot, we'll do a better job of making decisions. But maybe you can share how this sweet spot analysis works inside your business model, and how could someone apply this concept like today to start improving where their focus is?
That's a great question, Melanie. So if you're listening to this, I want you to think about for your company, what's the single biggest limiting factor currently over the next 90 to 120 days in your business? And so, for example, let's say you said, well, David, our number one challenge is sales conversion. And really, when we dive deeper, it's capacity. We don't have enough salespeople for the leads that are coming in. And so they're not getting followed up on well. Let's just use that as an example. So a sweet spot analysis says, okay, I identify this number one constraint to growth. We call this capital L limiting factor, capital L, capital F. And I say, okay, I brainstorm a minimum of 10 solutions to push back this limiting factor. For example, I might say, be better with my lead distribution. I should need to have better follow-up systems with that. How can I have some automated videos do some of the selling? How can I hire more salespeople? I come up with at least 10 ideas to push it back. And now that I have all these ideas, I go and I put them through two filters in two separate times. So first filter is the low-hanging fruit filter. I go to every idea on that list and say, is this a low-hanging fruit? Which means, is it easy to do with a high likelihood of working? If it's easy to do, high likelihood of working, I check off the box that says low-hanging fruit. And actually at the end here, you'll give everyone a website. They can actually download the PDF tool that I'm talking about for the sweet spot analysis. So I go through, is this a low-hanging fruit? Is this a low-hanging fruit? If it is, I check the box for low-hanging fruit. Then in a second separate pass, I ask of every item on my list of ideas, is it a home run? And a home run means if it works, will it have a big impact? Will it move the needle a lot? And after I've gone through the list, I look for those things that are both low-hanging fruit and home runs, because by definition, those are my sweet spot ideas. And think about that. They're easy to do, high likelihood of working, and big impact items. And so what it does is it gives me a simple way to lower the number of choices that I have to the fewer things that make a bigger difference. And you know, I'm sure everyone listening to this right now, you have a to-do list that goes to 14 pages, or if it's on your phone, it's like 75 swipes up. You can't get it all done. And so if you're trying to choose between two different tactics, or 10 different tactics, or 15 different tactics, this is a simple way to kind of rethink through and you pick just the sweet spots to go after. And if you have too many sweet spots to go after, any one of those sweet spots are great things to do. So only pick one or two or whatever you have the actual resources of attention to go after at once. Do that really well, then revisit your list and pick the next one after you've got one executed and working for you.
It's like, you know how my audience thinks, because I was going to ask you, what if they have a whole bunch of sweet spots? Because that's what we do as entrepreneurs, right? We come up with ideas, we have lots of opportunities, and there's 100,000 things we all want to do at once, right?
That's great. Well, all of our coaching clients have the same challenge. I mean, they're, you know, they chase bright, shiny objects, or they have all these things on their plates, but the same things apply here. So I love that your audience thinks the same way.
And you mentioned your Freedom Toolkit. We might as well just share that with our listener right now. And then I've got a couple questions I want to ask you before we wrap up today. But David, why don't you explain what your Freedom Toolkit is, and we'll tell them the URL they can find it at.
Great. So the Freedom Toolkit, when we wrote the Freedom Formula, there was a whole bunch of things I wanted to include, but my publisher said, no, we can't do that in a hardcover book. Like, I wanted to give people downloads of the PDF tools that we talked about, and I wanted to put a couple of videos as part of it. So what we did is we put together a free toolkit of these growth tools for a business entrepreneur, self-employed professional, or someone who leads inside of someone else's business. And at freedomtoolkit.com, you can actually get a sneak peek of the Freedom Formula. Make sure you love it. You get the first two chapters for free. And if you love it, you can go onto Amazon or go to your local bookstore and get a copy of that. And as you register your book, you actually get access to all those other tools. And they're quite extensive. We put probably 6+ months of time and effort building this toolkit together to help you apply what you learned about in the book. And it also has a framework to take your team through it, your staff through the book, chapter by chapter for the first half. And the first half is about, how do you work smarter? How do you operationalize personally working smarter? And the second half is, how do you get your team and your company working smarter?
Great. I love it. FreedomToolkit.com. And I will make sure this is linked up in the show notes. So if you're frantically trying to write this down, or your pen ran out of ink, or you're distracted, you know you can always find it on the show notes at the AmplifierSuccessPodcast.com page. Oh my gosh, there's so many things I want to ask you, but I feel like we should wrap this back to freedom.
Please.
You know, I think, at least in my experience, so many of the people that I've worked with over the years, and I think you work with over the years, mm-hmm. they build a business that becomes a job. Hmm. It does not give them freedom, right? And so, you know, like, I started a business because I wanted freedom. Within the first 6 months, I had wrapped myself right back into a job, and I had this wake up moment of, what have I done? Like, I've really recreated a job. And then I figured out, all right, so how do I bring lifestyle back into it? And I would love to hear your take on, how do we, if we're already in a business that's overwhelming and eating up every ounce of our life, how do we carve out that lifestyle experience? Or, and this is even a little more exciting for me, if you are starting from scratch right now, as you're listening in, how do you build the business that keeps that lifestyle front and center?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So I remember it was in 2001. I had built what was my second company. The first one failed. It went under. The second business, this is about 4 years into it. And I was, by every marker I had set, successful from the business. I was 29 years old. The business was generating a lot of profit. I was successful, but I was working like 80 hours a week. I was traveling literally two and a half weeks every single month, doing talks, leading workshops, keynotes, and I was burning out. And I remember talking to my business partner, and we both made this decision. We said, hey, within the next 15 months, we chose by the end of June, and 15 months in the future, we want to be out of the day-to-day production of our service offering. And it was a coaching business. And at the time, we were coaching probably anywhere from 100 to 120 clients a year. And that decision was impossible. How could we possibly get out of doing this? But we made that choice. And not only did we meet that goal, but within 4 years, we were then working with about 2,000 coaching clients a year. And obviously, we couldn't do that anymore. And so that decision led to this distinction called strategic depth. And strategic depth says, do I have the systems, the cross-trained team, and a culture of systematizing, using systems and cross-training such that it's not reliant on any one person? And that's not just you, the owner. that also goes for any of the key team members with that. I mean, I was talking with Teresa Watson, who's our company's COO, yesterday. And if she didn't have backups for her, how is she going to ever take a vacation, right? Or heaven forbid something goes on in her family and she needs to take a leave of absence for a month to care for an elderly family member. We want to have her back. We want to make sure when she comes back, things have been taken care of and that everyone else's roles are still protected with that. And so if I come from that frame from the start, and we just make it part of our culture, that we're going to build systems, but we're also going to make sure that we have a company wherein we use systems, we cross-train on systems, we capture historic key company knowledge inside of a centralized place. And by doing this process, and there is a straightforward mechanics to doing it, which I talk about in Chapter 4, the Freedom Formula, but the big distinction is I have to build the business to be more than just one person. At first, I have to build it to be owner independent. But more than that, I want to make sure that all my key staff are backed up as well and the other functions, because if I don't do that, I don't have a scalable business. And it's funny, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine. His name's Jeff. He was one of the founding team members for Priceline.com. And he was my co-author for my 10th book, which is called Scale. And he and I were talking. They went from zero to 200 million in sales in 2 years and went from 200 million to a billion in sales in two more years. They could not have done that if they only had a few key people who could do things. They had to have strategic depth. And whether your ambitions are to grow by 50% or 500%, or in Jeff's case, 50,000%, I don't know what it is, but without strategic depth, I'm trapped and I'm just going to be running on that treadmill for the rest of my life.
I love the idea of strategic depth as a way of languaging how powerful systems are. And I'm thinking to myself as you're talking, like I'm a systems geek. I love systems, but I have so many clients who their brains literally like freeze when they get so paralyzed when you say sure. System, right? They think, oh, it's gonna erode my freedom. It's going to make me have to do things in a certain way. And I'm not gonna have that creative expression. And I think it's really important to always come back to this idea that systems deliver freedom. They don't limit freedom.
That's right. That's a great distinction with that part. And a lot of our clients are the same way. What I tell them is, number one, they don't have to be the one creating all the systems. But if they don't honor the systems in their company, how are they going to be a model of a leader for their other people? I'm guilty of it. I think if anyone in our company is going to shortcut a system, it's probably me. And I've worked hard not to do that as often as I used to. I still have a lot of room to grow in that. But if we as leaders don't embrace systems, our staff won't. And if our staff don't embrace systems, then our business by definition is going to be limited and constrained and not create what we really want to do in the world.
Well said. As you're listening in, if this is speaking to you, I want you to go right now and get David's Freedom Toolkit, freedomtoolkit.com. My guess is you can get to it on your phone or on your computer, wherever you are. You can always... go back to it later if you don't have time to go through it all in this moment, but you want to make sure you grab a copy of it. So David, I always like to end my conversations that are so inspiring with a little bit more personal question.
Sure.
And I think sometimes people hear about all these successes and, you know, you've alluded to the fact that you've been building businesses for years. What do you think is the boldest thing you had to do to get to the level of success you're enjoying today?
Oh, that's a great question. At various stages, I mean, the first one was the decision to actually be a business owner was the boldest thing, I think. That would be 25 years ago. And a guy asked me to be his business partner. And I could have easily said, no, I don't have the money to put into that, which was like $15,000, $16,000 is what the upfront cost was, which I put my half on a credit card. But I could have just said, hey, I want to be your employee. So that was probably an early stage. Later on, I think today, if I look over the last 5 or 10 years, the boldest thing I had to do as a business owner is to accept it. We call them these hard truths about the business, to be able to look at the places where things aren't working in the business and accept ownership of places where we weren't doing things as well as we wanted to. And I'll give a quick example. In our business, for what we do, we had to look at, for example, how we were going to scale the coaching process that we do and the reliance on me and other things. That's been a journey for us over the last 10 years. And I think it's been really a tough thing, but a really good growth spark to ask, where are the places that I don't want to look at it, the hires I made that didn't work, or the decisions I made that didn't work out, and just face them straight up. We want to look at those straight in the eye. And when I do that, I can fix them or learn from them and improve them. But that's been a real tough one for me. And I think over the last 10 years, that's probably been the area in the business world of the biggest growth for me.
Oh, I love that you shared that, though, because we all have areas that are not working, or maybe we're not what we need to be in order to go to that next level. But so many people think they're just supposed to kind of override that and push through. And I think what you just said is so powerful. Like, if you are brave enough to go into the crevices of what's not working and fine tune that and become a better leader, become a better business owner, or become better at your craft, whatever that is, you actually have the power to leap into that next level. So thanks for being a great example of that.
I appreciate that, Melanie. And I agree with what you just said there. I think you put it really a good way. The shadows of the crevices that we don't want to look at, that's a great way of expressing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we all have those, don't we? All right. Well, I loved talking with you today, David, and I'm really glad that you put this book out. I think it's going to be a really powerful compass for so many business leaders, business owners, and you know, we all can use a little more freedom in our life and in our business. So grab thefreedomtoolkit.com, and I hope you'll actually continue on and get David's book as well and just power through it. So David, thank you so much for joining me today.
I appreciate it, Melanie. It's been a real pleasure.
This is Melanie Benson, your host. Thanks so much for listening in today. If you want to catch up on any of the show notes and circle back on any of the resources we shared in today's show, head on over to the show page at AmplifyYourSuccessPodcast.com. And remember, you amplify your results faster when you're in a community of other people who are moving and shaking. Join us at AmplifyYourSuccessCommunity.com. One last thing. When you've gained insight from today's episode, help us share that and inspire other people by heading over to iTunes, subscribing, and give it a review. iTunes absolutely loves seeing these reviews pop up, and it actually helps boost my show's visibility. So I would be super grateful for your reviews. And as always, I love seeing your shares of these episodes on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Come find me over there. Tag me in your shares. I'll give you some social media love right back. So see you next week for another inspiring episode of Amplify Your Success Podcast.